Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowain. It's no secret that the cost of a college education is skyrocketing. What is perhaps less known is the financial difficulty in which many colleges and universities find themselves. Between declining enrollment, shrinking government funding, and growing competition, some of the nation's institutions of higher learning are in real danger of shutting their doors or teaming up with other institutions for survival. This hour, we're taking a look at the financial health of the higher education system. We'll explore why college is so expensive and what's being done to contain costs. Later, we'll look at how public colleges are making less financial aid available to the poorest students as they seek to raise revenues and their reputations. A reporter from ProPublica joins us a little later. But we begin with John Marcus. John is a contributing editor at the Hechinger Report and has written about higher education for the New York Times, USA Today, Higher Education Magazine, and other publications. He was also a contributor to the book Reinventing Higher Education. John, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks very much for having me.
So you've written that some colleges and universities may be going the way of the music and journalism industries. What did you mean by that?
Well, the financial model on which universities and colleges are depend has changed so drastically over the last couple of decades that although it looks to us on the outside as if tuition is increasing, the universities themselves are actually losing ground. And the reason that that's happening is to continue to attract students. Some colleges, typically small private colleges with small endowments, often single gender and religiously affiliated institutions, have to give back so much of their tuition revenue in the form of financial aid just to fill their seats that they're sort of swimming upstream, and they're giving back as much as 56% in some cases that we've looked at of their revenue goes right back out the door, and then on top of which they have to pay for faculty and employees. They're really struggling to keep their heads above water.
Well, it raises the question, John, why is college tuition set up the way it is? In other words, you're talking about, in this case, smaller institutions, often single-gender institutions, that may be hit hardest by this, and yet these are some of the most expensive colleges sometimes for students to attend. And I'm thinking of the parent who's listening and saying, you know, even with if that 50% discount brings it down to, you know, $20,000, that doesn't feel like much of a discount from a parent's point of view.
Well, these colleges typically don't have other sources of revenue. They may have small endowments. Their endowments took a hit in 2008. They may have rebounded to a degree, but they really, many of these smaller colleges have not recovered. They need repairs. They need maintenance. They are very, very labor intensive. All of these things sort of work against their ability to reform themselves and to make themselves more efficient, as do the fact that universities and colleges haven't historically had to do that. There were always plenty of students. There was always plenty of money. When things changed, and I liken this to the music and the journalism industries, the people in charge suddenly found themselves having to do something that they never had to do before, which is figure out how to survive when the money stopped pouring in. And that's what's happened now in higher education. And a lot of those families and parents are choosing colleges and universities on the basis of cost, and enrollment overall has declined actually rather dramatically by the standards of American higher education, which has increased enrollment year after year after year. It's actually decreased almost 3% this spring on top of almost 2% last fall. That's quite a drop, and so a lot of these smaller colleges are struggling to attract students.
So the enrollment question, John, is that an issue of fewer students choosing to attend college? Is it a population issue? Why are we seeing a slowdown in enrollment?
Both of those factors are involved. The demographics have shifted. There's been a drop-off in the number of high school graduates who are the traditional college-going population. That will rebound over the next few years, but in the meantime, it came at a bad time for universities and colleges. As sluggish as the economic recovery has been, when the economy recovers, enrollment at universities tends to decline because people do find jobs and choose to take jobs rather than continue in school. And so all of those things have had an impact. Now, Are Penn or Temple seeing decreases in enrollment? No. Or in applications? Probably not. But smaller colleges with high price points have the problem of trying to prove to parents that they're worth the money, and increasingly they're having trouble doing that.
You've talked about how the schools at the top of the industry, so to speak, are not really facing this issue to the degree that others are.
No, and that's a problem, too, because they're the ones that set the agenda, and they're the ones that come up with the innovations and the new models for financing and innovating the means of underwriting higher education. And they're right now they're doing okay, and they may actually, this is interesting, they may not be doing as well as they say they're doing. So, for example, in the spring, we heard from a number of colleges and universities that they had a record number of applications. But if you listened very carefully to those announcements, they were talking about applications, which is different than applicants. Because now most universities and colleges accept what's called the common application form, they are getting more applications because each individual applicant, each high school kid, is sending out more applications, a third more applications than they did 5 or 10 years ago. So colleges and universities might be getting more applications, but there aren't necessarily more applicants behind them. So in fact, this probably is of some concern, even at the top, even in the most elite institutions, which are extraordinarily competitive and try to attract as many students and recruit as many students as they can. But where it's really hurting is the schools that don't really have those brand names, and the schools whose value is now being questioned by these families and students.
How about community colleges, John? How are they doing in all of this?
Community colleges are too popular for their own good. Many of them are overcrowded. Students can't get into classes that they'd like. Community colleges suffer from something of a reputation problem, whereas, in fact, we've done stories about the fact that many community college graduates with associate's degrees make more money than graduates of four-year universities with bachelor's degrees in some fields. But it's hard to get into community colleges because of budget cuts. Community colleges are publicly supported. Budgets have been reduced. Tuitions have been increased. And community colleges are actually a pretty good deal in a lot of areas, but don't get the respect that they deserve and can't always accommodate all the students. Many of them are open enrollment. They can't accommodate the students that want to take advantage of them. Many of those students then go to very expensive private for-profit universities and colleges. They too have seen really significant enrollment drops. Last spring, the enrollment at private for-profits decreased by 8%, which again is significant after triple-digit increases for the preceding 10 years. People are beginning to realize that although those private for-profit, often called proprietary schools, may teach courses that are at convenient times and located near where they live, they're very expensive in comparison to, for example, the same course at a community college, and the payoff isn't always really worth the money.
You talked about budgets being reduced, and certainly that brings to mind reductions in state and federal funding for so many schools. We've seen a drop in that for several years running now.
In state funding, absolutely. Almost everywhere in the United States, state funding for public universities has declined. Federal funding has declined in the area of research, not in the area of financial aid or grants. And now taxpayers are paying $150 billion a year in student grants and loans for higher education. It's interesting when you cover higher education that in exchange for all of that money, this particular administration has been asking for more accountability and transparency on the part of higher education. That is, you're taking all this money, $150 billion in taxpayer money, that includes loan subsidies, and about $35 billion worth of grants. What are we getting for it? How many of your students are graduating, for example? And the universities and colleges have been very firmly resistant to providing the kinds of data that that would help students make a reasonable comparison about the value of an education. And the president in August, when he announced his proposal for higher education, for lowering the cost of higher education, proposed rating the colleges or even ranking them based on their value. That hasn't been particularly popular among universities and colleges, but that seems to be the direction that people are going, giving consumer information to families to decide which university is worth the money, including on the basis of, among other things, how much money you will earn with your degree.
So there would be, as the administration calls it, a data palooza, right, that families can reference to get this information. And that brings up a couple of interesting points, because there are those schools that are choosing to incentivize the student, and we can talk about that. I've read that some are almost literally paying students to graduate on time to motivate them. But the Obama administration is looking more at motivating the institutions themselves. And there are some concerns about that, in terms of what colleges might do to compensate for that?
Yes, it's more than just the Obama administration. And in fact, given the dysfunction in Washington, it's unlikely that these kinds of policies will really get very far at the federal level. But at the state level, there's a new sort of paradigm that's called performance funding. So for many decades, universities and colleges, when policymakers were interested in increasing access to higher education, making sure, for example, that underrepresented minorities and low-income students had access to a college education, universities were incentivized to increase the number of students they enrolled. They were budgeted, if they were public, they got their money based on their enrollment. But there was no financial incentive for the universities to actually graduate any of these students. Now that has shifted to this emphasis on completion. So universities and colleges in many states are being budgeted now based on their success rates, how many students graduate, how many students stay or return after their freshman year for their sophomore year, which is a point at which many students drop out. Those are meant to incentivize the institutions to help their students to succeed. There are some fears about that. If you are being funded based on how many of your students graduate, you may be encouraged to accept only students that you know will succeed and not accept students who apply who may be marginal and have great potential or went to a weak urban high school as opposed to a wealthy suburban high school. So there's a concern about that. And the other danger is that you might make it easier to graduate. You might lower the standards. You might lower the grade point average that's required. You might press your faculty to not fail people. So there are those concerns as well about the unintended consequences of performance funding.
John, we have just less than a minute before we go to break, but I know that at least two states are doing something like that, correct? California and Colorado are using education funds to incentivize the institutions. Do we know yet how well that's working out?
Many more states than two are doing it. States like Indiana have jumped into this. In some states, the proportion of the funding based on performance is very small. In others, it's very large. In Indiana, it's very large, and in fact, the results have been very positive, and they've seen significant increases in many public institutions in the number of students who graduate.
I want to talk a little bit more about Indiana, because I know that there are some incentives there at University of Indiana, I believe it is, for students to encourage them to stick around and to graduate and hopefully graduate on time. We'll talk about that and much more, plus your calls. Perhaps you're a college student or a parent who's paying tuition, or you work at an institution of higher education. We'd love to hear from you when Radio Times comes right back.
AM 1112 Productions, Philadelphia's All Comedy Theater Company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, Bunny Bunny, Gilda Radner, a sort of romantic comedy. An imaginary biography of comedy legend Gilda Radner, Bunny Bunny is a time capsule of Gilda's life and career. From her big break on Saturday Night Live, Bunny Bunny presents Gilda Radner in all her glory, sarcastic, charming, and always funny. Tickets and information at 1812productions.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, the new president of Iran comes to New York for the UN General Assembly. His supporters say he needs to change the world's view of his country.
I think many of people of the board think Iranian people are something like terrorist guys, but as you know, they are not. The people of Iran are good persons.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them take control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about higher education in America and the difficulties that many institutions are facing as enrollment is declining, funds are shrinking, students themselves are having difficulty paying the high cost of college tuition, and we are talking about the nature of the problem and what is being done to address it. Our guest for this portion of the program is John Marcus. He is a contributing editor at the Hechinger Report and has written extensively about higher education for a number of publications, including the Boston Globe magazine, the Washington Post, and the New York Times. And we welcome your calls and your comments as well. The number is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear your perspective on the health of higher education in America. Whether you're a student, a parent, a faculty member, or otherwise, we are interested in hearing from you. Again, it's 888-477-9499. John, when we left off, we were talking about this whole idea of providing incentive to the institutions, holding them accountable for student success and so forth. We talked about President Obama's plan, and we talked about how a number of states, as you said, are now using their education funds to incentivize the institutions. And you said that it's met with pretty good success thus far, correct?
It has. It has met with some good success in the states that have really pushed it, and it's spreading all across the country. The idea of performance funding, and I think that the higher education sector is beginning to accept the need to address these outcomes problems. I mean, the problem that these states are trying to fix, the problem that they're trying to fix with performance funding, is one that people outside higher education are sort of astounded when they hear, which is that only about 55% of students at U.S. universities and colleges on average graduate within even 6 years with a four-year degree, and fewer than 20% graduate within 3 years with a two-year community college degree. So all of these students are going to college, spending all this money, taking out these loans, and not graduating. And I like to say that if a private sector industry had performance like that, had outcomes like that, it would be out of business. And colleges and universities have sort of become complacent about the idea that they were being funded based on access, not completion. And only now have they begun to push for graduation rates, often because outside elements have pushed them to.
Doesn't that bode well, then, for President Obama's plan, since his plan is all about accountability as well?
Well, I mean, how can I put this without sounding political? I'm not sure if whether making sense is matters anymore when you propose a policy in Washington, but it does seem to make sense. And it does pick up on what a number of states are already doing. So, and part of what the president would like to do ultimately with this information about colleges and universities that are the best value for the money is use that to determine how to direct all of those more than $150 billion worth of federal financial aid. Universities and colleges that do well and that are efficient and effective in educating students at a reasonable price would be eligible for more of the federal financial aid, and those that do a poor job and are overpriced would get less. Whether that will succeed or not is a huge question mark, but it, again, mimics something that's happening at the state level, which is that many states also provide financial aid for students, a collective total of about $11 billion nationwide. And several of these states are also using the financial aid they give to students to help push students to graduate. Until a few years ago, if you asked the state how many of the students who received financial aid ever graduated, they didn't even know. They didn't track it. So they would give the student the money and say, see you later, good luck. The money would eventually run out, but that wasn't enough of an incentive to really push the student, motivate the student to graduate on time. what they're doing now in many states is requiring the student, in exchange for receiving state financial aid, to take a certain number of credits per semester, more credits than they likely would have otherwise. And research has shown that the more credits you take, the faster you finish, and the faster you finish, the more likely you are to graduate without churning through college or university for 5, 6, 7 years and never graduating. So universities states are also using money to motivate students as they are to motivate universities.
Let's talk a little bit about consolidation, John, because we've been seeing that all over the country. In fact, we've seen it in our region with Rutgers most recently. So how many schools are deciding that that's the way that they're going to go, that they're going to merge with another institution just for the sake of survival, typically, and how? What are the results thus far?
Well, they're not really deciding. It's not. It gets to a point where they don't have a choice. In some cases, in the case of private universities, mergers occur because a weaker institution is unable to continue, and they're absorbed by a stronger institution. Often, they're absorbed by private for-profit institutions because the most valuable asset of a college or university is its accreditation. Where this is happening more frequently is at the public level, where legislators are requiring that universities and colleges consolidate. This has happened extensively, for instance, in Georgia. It's probably too early to know. There have been immediate savings in places like Georgia of a few million dollars at some institutions where there have been mergers. But it's too early to know about the long-term impact. It seems logical that over time, mergers would create efficiencies. They're very hard to pull off because universities and colleges have lots of constituencies, lots of vested stakeholders. They have alumni, they have students, they have faculty, they have political stakeholders and communities represented by state legislators who don't want to see their local institution subsumed by someone else. So it's a complicated process. Many more of these mergers have been proposed than have actually occurred, but I think it's likely you'll see more of them. And in a few cases, there have been private universities. There's a university based in California. It's essentially, I guess you'd call it a university chain called National University that has absorbed several smaller colleges and universities. What that allows it to do is offer a broader range of curriculum and to provide all of the services to these disparate campuses centrally, which saves a lot of money. So you have seen that here and there among private universities and colleges voluntarily in a few places because smaller colleges have been able to continue and had to be merged, and at the state level because legislators are just tired of subsidizing two campuses 3 miles apart and have required that the universities consolidate.
And yet, John, is there not a downside to that in the sense that sometimes it can actually cost more for at least one of the institutions? I'm thinking about Rutgers and its merger with University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey not too long ago. And if our research is correct, Rutgers inherited something like a $500 million debt with that consolidation.
Huge amount of debt. And yes, your research is correct. And that was a big problem and relatively controversial. That debt would have had to be paid by someone someday anyway. But yeah, now it's Rutgers' problem. So there are issues of wherein the cost can actually be significant over time. The savings may be less than thought, and you also risk alienating donors and alumni who don't like the fact that the college on their diploma doesn't exist anymore. One of the universities in Georgia actually did a very good job, was very diplomatic and strategic about the way it underwent the merger. So students that were enrolled prior to the merger, when they graduated, had the option of having a degree with the name of the university as it existed when they enrolled rather than when they graduated. So those kinds of things do help. They seem trivial, but our loyalty and affection for an investment in the colleges and universities we attend is very strong, and that's one of the disincentives to these mergers.
Yeah. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY, and we are talking about higher education, the health of higher education in America. The number to join our conversation is 888-477-9499. We'll go to the phones now to Wayne, Pennsylvania, and Milton. Welcome, Milton, to Radio Times.
Hi. I have a specific question. I'll take my answer off the air. Do you think your variables apply to top-tier schools? For example, I want to be a scientist at MIT. That's just a general example. Do you think they apply to top-tier schools where you want to go to a graduate school? And if they do not apply, what percentile away from the top would you say that top tier starts, or how many schools? I'll keep my answer off there.
That's a great question. Bain and Company, the financial consulting firm, concluded that one-third of colleges and universities are in financial trouble. And they included in that estimate a number of very prominent universities and colleges with good brands. Those universities and colleges have a lot of buffers. They have large endowments. They have wealthy alumni. They're likely not to close or merge. But are they concerned? Yes. They have seen more cost sensitivity. They are probably likely also giving larger discounts, and they are trying to accommodate a different kind of consumer, and acknowledging that a student is a consumer, which is a relatively new idea in higher education than they used to. A greater mind than my mind, Bob Zemsky, who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education and is sort of the dean of people among people who follow and research higher education, has suggested that until the elite universities begin to acknowledge that there's a problem with the cost structure, no one in higher education will take it seriously, because until the elites lead the rest, and until the elites begin to take action, it's unlikely that there'll be really concerted action to lower the cost of higher education elsewhere.
And the elites don't necessarily have the incentive at this point, correct?
Certainly not as much as some of the smaller colleges. The caller, by the way, also mentioned graduate education. Graduate education makes money for universities, and some of the smaller colleges that are being very smart about how they handle this problem are expanding their graduate programs, because graduate programs often subsidize undergraduate programs. There's a little-known, almost insidious subsidy process in higher education, wherein if you're in a public university, out-of-state students pay more, thereby subsidizing in-state students. Lower class, in other words, sophomores and freshmen, subsidize seniors and juniors, because those entry-level classes have larger class sizes. They're cheaper to teach. As you progress into the senior and junior year, you're in smaller seminars, you're much more expensive. So lower-classmen subsidize upperclassmen. International students subsidize everybody. Rich kids subsidize poor kids. So there's a process. It's almost like when you buy a ticket on an airplane that everybody pays a different price, and that's also the case at universities. And graduate students are significantly subsidizing undergraduates.
We'll go back to the phones to Perkasie, Pennsylvania, and Bruce. Welcome, Bruce, to Radio Times.
Good morning, Tracy. I'm delighted to be on. It feels to me like I'm listening to a brilliant representative from another dimension. I just sent my third child to college, so I've got three in college now. And part of that process was a tour of nine universities in 7 days last fall in New England. And that and prior visits in prior years have shown me not a single visit that yielded a university that did not have a vast construction project underway. I find it mind-boggling that I'm supposed to be concerned that there are some small universities that are struggling financially when we're looking at a generation, I think, who will not be able to afford to buy a house in their late 20s, who will not then gain the equity by their late 40s to send their own children to college. And we are in such an unsustainable model that I just can't imagine anything other than hoping for a disruptive technology that will correct all of this. I mean, you're saying that kids are graduating at diminishing rates? Of course. What choice do they have than to get out of this system as soon as they can find employment, rather than continue to, you know, collect this burdensome debt?
Well, Bruce, thank you. You brought up a number of interesting points. And, John, I'd like you to respond to that from a parent's point of view.
That's a very interesting observation. I've made that observation as well, having traveled on assignment in California, which has had one of the most significant higher education budget crises of any state in the country, and seen nothing but construction cranes on public university campuses. In the few years after the start of the economic downturn, universities and colleges in America built a record amount of, that is, by in dollars, spent a record amount on new construction. Universities love to build things. Donors love to have their names in new buildings. Presidents love, when they retire, to talk about all the new buildings that they've built. And I defy you to ever find a building that a university tears down. But they like to build new ones. And so it's sort of mind-boggling. Many universities and colleges make the case that the cost of these buildings come from different budgets. They come from capital budgets, not operating budgets. But once they're finished, they have to be maintained and heated and cooled and repaired, and that comes out of operating budgets, and it's a significant amount of money. The caller also mentioned that he went to a number of – he did the college tour through the New England, the iconic New England colleges and universities. A survey earlier this month of presidents of small New England colleges who were surveyed by their own higher education association here in New England, where I'm based, 43% of the presidents of small New England colleges disagreed with the question as to whether the small New England college will remain an important fixture within the academic landscape. So even presidents are pessimistic that their institutions will continue. And the caller also mentioned the idea of new technology coming in and allowing for a lowering of the cost of higher education. And the most anticipated new technology is called the MOOC. It stands for Massive Open Online Course. That is the delivery of a course online that you can take anytime you want. Some of these courses offered by the likes of Stanford, Harvard, and MIT are free, and they enroll tens and tens of thousands of students at a time. The problem with MOOCs is that no one yet knows whether they work. There's been no research into their pedagogical effectiveness, and what research does exist into online education shows that the outcomes are actually inferior to a brick-and-mortar classroom rather than superior to it. So the jury is still out about what impact MOOCs will have, and people are beginning to some of the enthusiasm for MOOCs is beginning to wane as to whether they'll be a viable cost-saving device for higher education.
So, John, in light of all this, in our last minute on the air, what is a prospective college student / parent to do? What is your advice for someone who's got children in college, about to send children off to college, in light of everything that we're seeing, all these developments financially and otherwise? How would you advise someone who's in that position?
One of the strangest things about the history of higher education in America is, until very recently, people would sacrifice anything it took to send their child to whatever college or university they wanted to attend. That's changing, and students and their parents are looking for value. And one way that you can investigate the value of a college or university is going to a federal website called the College Navigator, which is maintained by the U.S. Department of Education. And you can plug in institutions that you're interested in and compare them side by side on a dashboard that will show you the comparative actual net price, not the sticker price that they advertise as tuition, but what the average student actually pays after grants and discounts. I strongly encourage you, students and their parents to ask for discounts. Often people don't know to ask, and when they ask, they'll often get them. I also encourage them to exhaust their eligibility for federally subsidized student loans, which are cheaper and much more flexible, before taking out private loans, which are much, much more expensive and difficult to defer.
John Marcus, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
John has written extensively about higher education for the Hechinger Report and a number of other publications. When we come back, we'll find out why some colleges are withholding financial aid from some of the neediest students. Radio Times will be right back.
The Resident Ensemble Players, Delaware's professional acting company, supports WHYY. The Rep presents Tennessee Williams' The Night of the Iguana, September 26th through October 13th. Lust and loneliness haunt the life of Shannon, a renegade clergyman on the run, until he meets inspiration in Hannah, the soft-spoken but straight-talking artist who shows Shannon the power and freedom in acceptance. For tickets, 302-831-2204 or DelawareRep.org.
Al-Shabaab, the terrorist organization that was not apparently on the ropes.
This particular attack is really a failure on the part of the international community, including the United States.
How a ragtag Somali guerrilla organization took on the world in a Nairobi shopping mall. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
today at noon on WHYY.
The American Philosophical Society Museum supports WHYY and presents Through the Looking Lens. This exhibition highlights never-before-seen watercolors by British artist-inventor Cornelius Varley. Varley's precise images were captured before the advent of photography in the 19th century, using drawing instruments he invented, which museum visitors are invited to try for themselves. Through the Looking Lens reveals the full breadth of Varley's work at the intersection of history, art, and science. More at apsmuseum.org.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Moskowain, and we're talking about the failing financial health of higher education in the United States. Not all colleges and universities are in big trouble, of course, but a combination of dropping enrollment, fewer state and federal dollars, and outdated financial management are threatening the long-term existence of a number of schools. As expensive as a college education can typically be, a new report by ProPublica now suggests that public colleges are making less financial aid available to their poorest students in an effort to raise their revenues and reputations. Marion Wang is a reporter with ProPublica and joins us now to talk about this emerging trend. Marion, welcome to Radio Times.
Tracy, glad to be here.
So the story that you wrote for the Chronicle of Higher Education focuses on a young woman from Philadelphia, actually, who was, by all accounts, a good college prospect, also emblematic, perhaps, of the way that some public colleges and universities are shifting their financial priorities away from the neediest students and toward wealthier and higher scoring ones. Tell us a little bit about Shaniqua's story.
So Shaniqua lives in South Philly. She is from a low-income family. Her family lives in Section 8 housing, and she has overcome a lot. She worked really, really hard in high school and graduated second of her class. She would, frankly, be the first, and she was the first in her family to go to college. And she's, you know, in a lot of ways, exactly the kind of student that one would want to see get into a four-year, succeed, graduate, and sort of make a better life for herself, and achieve those goals, wanting to be the first in her family to sort of do this different thing.
And tell us about what happened with her, because she certainly seemed like an ideal candidate, and yet things did not work out for her the way that she had hoped.
Right. So Shaniqua actually applied for entrance to several colleges. She got into three different state schools in Pennsylvania, three different public institutions. And she got in, which was, you know, wonderful. But when it came to getting the financial aid package, she realized there just wasn't going to be enough money for her. And so she still had with the most she could take out in student loans and under her own name. And even, you know, the federal Pell Grant for needy students and the state FIA grant for needy students, it just, that stopped covering the cost of even the more affordable public institutions in Pennsylvania several years ago. And so she still had a gap. And it's not easy to come, for a low-income student, you know, it's not easy to come up with a gap necessarily. And she, you know, she's working, she has a job, but she felt, ultimately, she went over it with her counselors at this organization, Philadelphia Futures, and they talked about the financial situation based and the debt she would be taking on already, and she ultimately decided to go to college.
And why is that happening, Marion, that here's a student who is a good student, very active in extracurriculars and so forth, also has a great financial need? It would sound like the recipe for someone who would qualify for all kinds of aid, perhaps even some scholarships. Why was she not a candidate for those things, or why was that funding not available to her?
Well, so generally colleges have their lot of money to give out to students, and it's generally, they either label it as need-based aid or this is merit-based aid. Those are the two general categories they have. Now, it's very squishy because sometimes places will, you know, it's up for definition. It's up to the school to sort of define what falls in category. But in general, the schools that she applied to just simply, they were state schools, simply prioritized merit-based aid, which if you look at standardized tests, just because of the way that standardized scores tend to be correlated with income, that generally skews toward the wealthier students. Who have test prep, who go to top tier schools, who have sort of peer reinforcement, you know, and that sort of high expectations of from a young age. And she went to a school that, you know, a third of kids at school didn't graduate. And you all know what's happening to the Philadelphia public school system. And she worked and graduated toward the top of her class there, but, you know, that simply didn't make her pretty very competitive, given her scores, for some of these merit scholarships where schools are really trying to target those scholarships towards students that have scores that will help the institution, frankly, move up in the rating.
Well, isn't there a certain irony, though, Marion, in the fact that the schools that are designed to make higher education most accessible are the same ones that are, in some cases, making it less accessible? I'm thinking about the fact that one of the schools that this young lady was accepted to was Lincoln University, which is historically black college/university that was formed in part at least to make college accessible for African-American students like Shaniqua who were being excluded from other schools.
One thing to say, you know, in the school's defense is that, you know, public are in this area very much, they're getting into this sort of, they call financial aid leveraging and the use of merit aid that's becoming much more prevalent at public universities, but they are trailing the private universities quite a bit. I mean, they have been doing this for some time, but we focused on publics because we thought, one, you know, institutions enroll so many more students that systemically it's a much greater difference if they're hitting their priorities. But also that, yes, you're absolutely right. Publics do have a, you know, compelling mission to be that hold the line on access for low-income students. And we did that to be a source of tension for these schools, and many of them will acknowledge it.
And also, Marion, I'm just wondering about the fact that consultants say that a lot of public colleges and universities are coming to them, and they're trying to get help attracting, quote, smart students who can pay. Talk about the nature of competition among colleges and universities these days that has forced many of them to shift their priorities and shift their finances as well.
Right. Definitely these schools have a lot of demands on them, especially in the past few years. You've seen pretty steep budget cuts faced by these public institutions. They're just getting much less state support, and especially a lot less state support per student, you know, as enrollments have increased, and the per student funding has fallen pretty steeply. There is, you know, and given those pressures, I don't want to downplay those sort of revenue demands. The schools have had to rely more on tuition revenue, and that means a mix of students who will bring in that, you know, dollar amount that you need, frankly. And so there's been a fundamental shift in some ways about from public thinking about financial aid as something to help students who need it to thinking about, you know, using financial aid to help the schools get students that it needs for revenue or for rankings or what have you. And, you know, it's referenced it before, it's called financial aid leveraging, how schools can sort of use their financial aid to get those students. And often, you know, we talked to people for our story who said, you know, yeah, I worked at a state institution, and one of the things I was asked to do was sort of go and give aid to, you know, pretty good out-of-state students. You know, not the best, not the valedictorians, but, you know, pretty good out-of-state students who wouldn't really require that much aid in order to get them to come. And they'd be paying a higher out-of-state tuition rate, and, you know, net, they would bring the university more revenue than even a full-pay in-state student.
And there's certainly the concern about, you know, the U.S. News and World Report rankings and those other barometers that people use pretty heavily to get a sense of which are the best schools and to make their plans accordingly. Marion, what are some of the perks that universities are offering those students that they really do want to attract?
Well, it differs. But most of the time you'd see, you know, what we call merit or scholarships, little discounts in the financial aid package and range, you know, very widely depending on the institution's particular strategy. You'll see some schools wanting to get those, you know, pretty good out of state for, you know, perhaps revenue reasons, and they'll throw in a couple dollars. It's a small discount. The student will still bring in a good bit of revenue. And you'll see other schools that really, really prioritize the rankings, you know, want this feather in their cap. They want to be able to brag about how they have the most national merit scholars of any school in the country. And they will give a full ride to the most competitive students because they want to be able to say that. And so it really, you'll see sometimes, you know, you'll see anything from a couple thousand dollars to a full ride, free room and board, even a laptop, you know, lots of the range of perks really is pretty broad depending on what the institution is going for.
We talked a few minutes ago with John Marcus about the accountability movement in higher education, with the idea being to motivate the universities themselves and hold them accountable for the kinds of results that they are producing in terms of graduation rates, et cetera. What about the accountability movement, and how does it play into this kind of a situation? Does it help or hurt, for instance, a student like Shaniqua? Are we likely to see more of that? Where does the accountability movement fit into what we're seeing here in terms of colleges and universities shifting their financial priorities?
The accountability movement is definitely something to keep an eye on, because you see these states sort of starting to tie in what they call performance-based funding. So based on graduation rates is a big deal, retention rates is a big deal. And I think it's going to ultimately depend on how states are designing these systems. I know that's not a clear-cut answer, but it really depends on how those accountability systems are built. And so as states are doing this, sort of trying to steer and incentivize their public institutions in a particular direction, I think it's incredibly important to make sure that that system also accounts for the type of student that those colleges are enrolling. So if one were to design a system without any kind of checks, kind of incentives to continue enrolling low-income students, the cheapest and easiest way to up your graduation rates or to up some of those are to simply enroll students that aren't going to need as much support and are, you know, quote-unquote, better students. And that real possibility as the accountability movement kind of takes hold in more and more states, that's something that I hope folks designing these policies are considering and making sure that there's some incentive or institutions are given credit for the types of students that they're enrolling. So if they are taking on lower first-generation students that are going to need more support, that is factored into ultimately outcomes. And they're not compared on this, you know, one-size-fits-all sort of scale, because it's not at all one-size-fits-all.
So catch us up on Shaniqua then. You said that she was going to community college. What is her plan at this point?
Well, her plan is at this point to essentially, you know, what she's doing. She's taking on a really full course load this year, and she's very between that and her job. And she's just going to throw her to her studies and finish out this year and hopefully transfer to a four-year college eventually.
Does that put her in the same dilemma, though, Marion, if she applies to a four-year school, let's say 2 years into community college? Is she likely to face the same situation she was in as a prospective freshman in terms of funding?
I mean, the funding situation is definitely going to be an issue. I mean, at this, she does. If she is able to get through 2 years at a community college, she will, you know, that will be reducing ultimately what debt she's going to take on when she finishes at a 4-year. But that's a good question. And there are a lot of schools that have struck up these sort of agreements with community colleges that make it easier for students like Shaniqua, if they finish their associate's degrees, to sort of transfer to a 4-year. And that is to the credit of some of these 4-year schools. When you talk to people, though, they point that out, that, you know, these 4 years could have taken on Shaniqua. She could have been successful, and she likely will be successful, but, you know, that's leaving these students that are sort of on the margins already at risk, because they, when you research that when a student that undermatches, they go to a school that is less selective than the most selective institution could have gotten into, they lower their chances of graduation. And something that these 4 years are essentially saying, you know, we will catch you if and when you finish at the community college level. And Shaniqua has been fortunate. You know, she's beaten the odds, and she's worked really hard, and she has a lot of support from Philadelphia Futures, that college access group I talked about, and are going to see her through. But there are a whole lot of students out there that are like her that are going to, you know, they're definitely more at risk.
Marion, finally, in 30 seconds or less, for that student who is either low income, struggles academically, what do they need to know to put themselves in the best possible position to get an affordable college education?
I would definitely say work on, like, do your research, find out what schools are a good match for you academically, and apply to a good range of schools. Don't count yourself out at some of the more prestigious schools that, if you're a good match for and they admit you, some of the more prestigious schools that you might can't get into actually give a good amount of aid if you do get in. So definitely apply to a range of schools, but be prepared to sort of look at your financial aid package and make a difficult decision if it comes down to weighing student loan debt against future.
Well, Marion, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times. We've been talking with Marion Wang. She is a reporter with ProPublica and recently wrote a piece about how financial higher education institutions are withholding some of their aid from some of the neediest students. The health of higher education on Radio Times.